I've completed three of them, and they're eventually it'll be a installation where the room is a book.
All right. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
For being part of the show.
Thank
for our
you.
February outing in radio and computer land.
Oh, and can I plug, although I'm not sure what date it'll be, but in April, just a, April 29th, probably, the Street Roots Poets will be reading the Vendor Poets at the downtown branch of the library.
And of course, you folks will be reading Street Roots every week, so you'll follow up on looking for that
exactly.
announcement in the paper.
Exactly. Thank you, Judith.
So, thanks for listening, folks. Remember to support your local independent bookstores, your independent reading series, and, of course, independent radio. Good night.
This is KBOO Portland.
Cable is building a city of media makers. We believe that strong, resilient communities know how to make their own media. For 50 years, Cable has trained thousands of people how to make radio. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep the city activated and aware through radio we make together. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today.
Join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
When we are given the opportunity to share our stories,
opinions,
thoughts,
and ideas in a meaningful manner with each other over the airwaves,
not only does it increase our collective knowledge of what it means to be human,
but our stories also have potential to influence the public dialogue.
This is the power of KBOO.
You help expand the conversation.
Invest in future media makers
and join us on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Wind waves 1 foot or less. West swell 5 feet at 8 seconds. Slight chance of showers this evening. A chance of showers after midnight. Tuesday, light wind. Becoming light and show.
Tonight, Autolite presents the recreation in song and story of an American legend. You're about to hear what happened to...
Broadcasting live from the deck of the UV-1746 tugboat on the Willamette River, this is the Syndicate Radio, Steam Radio Syndicate.
Get you one?
I'm thirsty, honey.
Oh, I'm thirsty. I'm real thirsty.
All I got left is $9.
This is another installment in our Steam Folk series, in which each episode is centered around an old folk song. So far, we've taken you to the Big Rock Candy Mountains and to the railroad tunnel where John Henry swung a hammer. Today, we bring you deep into that darkness that lives in all of us. Live from the Willamette River, I'm Kitty Rocket with the Steam Radio Syndicate presenting Frankie and Johnny, the Great American Murder Ballad.
The recreation in song and story of an American legend. You're about to hear what happened to Frankie and Johnny.
Frankie and Johnny were lovers. At least that's what we've been told. Let's swear be true to each other.
the Winch Room, that was Three for Silver, beginning their take on the classic murder ballad Frankie and Johnny. Like many folk songs, there are dozens of versions, and we've put together some of our favorite verses into totally biased, not so definitive, best of medley. You'll be hearing more of this throughout the show. And a quick warning to the squeamish. This episode acknowledges the existence of violence, cheaters, and destruction of quality woodwork, none of which are endorsed by the Steam Radio Syndicate or our affiliates.
I'm gonna kill him, cause he's doing me wrong.
That being said, murder ballads can be found in every corner of American music, from country to blues, jazz to bluegrass. There's simply no shortage of songs recounting homicidal revenge, jealous lovers, or barroom brawls turned deadly. But their history goes back much further than this country. Songs and stories of murder ballads are probably as old as our opposable thumbs. What is this tickling fascination we have with murder? What is it about this forbidden act that captivates our imagination? Some of these songs are based on real events. In the case of Frankie and Johnny, the song was sparked by a single gunshot in 1899. The gun was held by Frankie Baker, jilted lover turned killer. But what was it that made Frankie's wrath so iconic? And why would anyone describe the sound of gunfire as Rudy Toot Toot? That sounds like bubblegum flavor, not homicide. Okay, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Now, from the depths of the engine room, here's Max Markley. On with the story.
Century, Frankie Baker was a young prostitute in St. Louis, known for her gaudy style and knack for making good money and spending it quickly. Johnny certainly was Frankie's man, but his name wasn't Johnny. It was, in fact, Alan Britt. Aside from being lovers, Alan was apparently her pimp. They lived and worked on Targhee Street in the heart of the red light district. When he wasn't busy attending to his pimping duties, sharp-dressed Alan played a mean ragtime piano. He was 17 years old.
Smelly boy!
Jealousy and self-defense led Frankie to shoot her man in the stomach. Alan was seeing another woman on the side, a rival prostitute named Alice Pryor. Like Alan, songwriters had some liberties with her name as well. Most versions of the song refer to her as Nellie Bly, though if you looked hard enough, you might find Alice Fry or even Annabelle Lee. Unlike the name Alice Pryor, which is clunky and takes an exhausting four syllables to produce, Nellie Bly just rolls right off the tongue. But let's leave Frankie and Johnny alone for a moment before the trouble really starts.
According to common murder ballad lore, a lot of pretty awful things happened on the banks of rivers. There's just something about all that flowing water that brings the worst out of all of us. Just ask Neil Young or Joan Baez, who both sang of tragedy adjacent to freshwater. Our own Leo J knows this as well as anyone. Live from the Wench Room, it's Leo J and Three for Silver with a fresh retelling of an old sad song.
Oh, Mary Kelly Brown was the fairest girl around, fairer than the snow upon the ground. But now there's talk among the town, and the window shades are down, 'cause that girl is nowhere to be found. Oh, Mary Brown and me were to be married in the spring, but I could not swing the cost of a ring. So upon her gentle hand, I tied a wedding band with a pebble and a golden string. If you would only say you're mine, and in no other's arms entwined, walk beside where the waters flow, down by the banks of the Ohio. Willie Orton Rounder, whose father runs a foundry, as tall and strong as any man I see. He took a liking to my girl, he promised chariots and pearls if she would leave me cold and wear his wedding ring. But my Mary's heart was true, she turned down all the gold he drew. Her lover's hand she could not bear to lose. And old Willie's temper fired, he grabbed her by the side and held her there above the coming tide. And she cried, oh Willie, oh, oh Willie, please, oh Willie, don't you murder me. Yes, she cried, oh Willie, oh, oh Willie, please. I'm not prepared for, I'm not prepared for eternity. If you would only say you're mine, and in no other's arms entwined, walk beside where the waters flow, down by the banks of the Ohio. Now the cotton's gone to seed, and old Willie's living free. I spend my nights to work that factory. But somewhere above the trees, I can see her when I dream. Mary Kelly Brown, she waits for me. If you would only say you're mine, and in no other's arms entwined, walk beside where the waters flow,
got Johnny. He comes back to the table from the bar, you ask him.
I'll do that. When he comes back. He ain't at the bar, Frankie.
Well, Frankie comes looking for Johnny. Well, I couldn't tell her no lie. So I quietly slipped her the info. He's out back with Nellie Bly.
This is the Steam Radio Syndicate. Broadcasting live from the deck of the UV 746 on the Willamette River, performing in the Wench Room, that was Leo J and Three for Silver with the song Mary Kelly Brown. And now, Jim Petzl in the Meat Locker.
As we mentioned, Alan Britt was quite the ragtime pianist. On the night of October 15th, he had a gig playing for a cakewalk at the Phoenix Hotel. Frankie went to the hotel, perhaps to hear him play and perhaps because she just had her suspicions about him. She caught him in the hallway with Alice Pryor doing, well, the kinds of things people do in hallways when they think no one is looking. Suffice to say, Frankie had seen enough to know that her man was doing her wrong. Frankie and Alan fought in the street, and Frankie went home alone. Alan went home with Alice Pryor.
Well, Frankie went down to the corner just for a bucket of beer. She said, hey, Mr. Bartender, has my lover Johnny been here? You see, he's my man, he never do me no wrong.
Broadcasting live from the Willamette River on the UV 746 warship. This is the Steam Radio Syndicate on KBOO 90.7 FM. We continue with the tragic tale of Frankie and Johnny, or Alan. Frankie is home alone after catching her man fooling around in a hallway. Nate Klett continues the tale.
You make my sad heart jump with joy, and when you're near, I just can't sit.
In the early morning hours, while Frankie slept, Alan entered her apartment, and the fight continued.
Frankie, I beg you, don't shoot me. They'll put you away in a cell. They'll put you where the cold wind blows from the hottest corner of hell.
When he pulled out his knife and started to attack her, Frankie grabbed the pistol she kept under her pillow. She shot him once in the chest. At least.
me over slow, roll me over softly. Your bullets have laid me low. I was your man, but I did you wrong. Now there'll be no flowers or tears, there'll be no mourners in black. Just amen, going to that graveyard and only seven are coming back. See, he was a man, but he was doing a
What really happened that night? Was Frankie acting out of self-defense or spite? To untangle this, we turn to our resident medium, who has done some serious summoning of spirits to help us get to the bottom of this mess. It's a Steam Radio exclusive. Behold the ghosts of Frankie, Johnny, and Nellie Bly. Nellie, are you with us? Nellie?
Call me Nellie or Alice or Mary Magdalene, and I saw just what I saw. Johnny had been eyeing me for weeks, that creep. He just played that piano so sweet at the cakewalk, I couldn't resist his advances. He was a smooth talker, I'll tell you what. And I'll tell you another thing, Frankie, honey. I certainly wasn't the only one. That teenager had some raging hormones. I can't say I knew very much about hormones back in those days, but I've been doing a lot of continuing education here in the Sweet Hereafter. But you know what? He said he'd never leave that Frankie. That despite all of his indiscretions, Frankie was his gal. And this business of pulling a knife on that lady? Please. He wouldn't even step on a spider. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got a game of cribbage to return to here in the underworld. So long.
Whatever that Nellie Bly whispered in your ears, just some hurdy-gurdy hooey. I'm Frankie Baker, and I did the killing, so I think I know what went down that night. Look, I was hip. I knew all about polyamorous arrangements, and I had no problem with Johnny having his fun. But right there in the hallway of the hotel, have some class, huh? I shrugged it off. I went home to get some sleep, but sure enough, at 3 a.m, here he comes. Just as drunk as can be, his shirt unbuttoned, hickeys all over his neck. He walked in and grabbed a lamp and started to throw it at me. I asked him, say, are you trying to get me hurt? And he just stood there and cursed. And I said, I am boss here. I pay rent and I have to protect myself. He ran his hand in his pocket and opened his knife and started around this side to try to cut me. I just ran my hand under the pillow and shot him. Didn't shoot but once, standing by the bed. Yeah, that boy was afraid of spiders, but he had no problem swatting me. The cops came soon enough. He got what he deserved, and so did I. My freedom. I went to trial on Friday the 13th, but that bad luck omens didn't go against me. Why, the judge even gave me back my gun.
Johnny, Alan, whoever he is, was not available for direct comment. But he did send us this message, and I quote, I'm just glad a sorry, no-good scoundrel like myself is still remembered. Hell stinks. But I'm like a minor celebrity down here. By the way, the best version of the song is that weird Sammy Davis Jr. version. What a weirdo. Love it. His words.
Untangle anything. It's always pretty hit or miss with ghosts. But here's what we do know for sure. Alan was taken to the hospital and Frankie arrested, contrary to the opinion of social media theorists. News actually traveled quite fast back then. But that evening, before Johnny had even succumbed to the fatal shot, a local songwriter, Bill Dooley, had composed and performed a ballad that would immortalize the story of Frankie and Alan Britt forever. There was something about the song. Maybe its jaunty, major key melody, an oddly upbeat choice for the grisly subject matter that lay at the foundation of a century of folk legend, pop culture references, and flagrant misinformation. For some final thoughts on this, we bring you back down to the dank, cavernous engine room with Max Markley, whose extensive lyrical researching turned up one surprisingly overlooked but possibly significant detail.
With all of the ways the story has been adapted to fit a good lyric, from the caliber of Frankie's revolver to something as trivial as the characters' names, there is one constant in all of the retellings: fine hardwood. There's the hardwood floor that Johnny collapses onto, according to Sam Cooke. Frank Crummett describes the bullet passing through the hardwood door, and Jimmy Rogers yodels basically the same thing. It's still hardwood, but it has become a revolving door, in the words of Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians. The exception that proves the rule is Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps, who describe the revolving door, but this time it's made of hard board. I'm no carpenter, but I'm pretty sure that's what IKEA uses to make futon frames. So what's with the hardwood fixation? What is it about deciduous lumber that made a century of troubadours stop and take note? Did it make the bullets all the more menacing if they could pass through the finest tight-grained joinery? Or maybe the ballad was originally started by some down-on-his-luck carpenter looking to make a few bucks with some deft product placement. I'll let you ponder these or your own conspiracy theories, but if we've learned nothing else here, we know that when it comes to murder ballad furniture, only the best will do.
Frankie and Johnny were lovers. Oh my gosh, how they could love. They swore to be true to each other, just as true as the stars above. He was her man. How a body done her wrong.
This is Steam Radio Syndicate on KBOO. We're broadcasting live from the steamship UV-746 on the Willamette River. We're featuring songs and stories inspired by Frankie and Johnny and other American murder ballads. I'm Kitty Rocket, reading from The Winch Room. Whatever your feelings are about songs involving murder, one thing is for sure. They keep the memory alive of some very disreputable individuals. Aside from Frankie, how many 19th century St. Louis prostitutes can you name? To delve into this a little deeper, here's a story from Leo J. called The Ballad of Big Ike.
Marla stood in the doorway of our home like an angry Norse goddess, in a red velour bathrobe, the frayed hem fluttering. In one hand was the peel of a banana, in the other, a quaking fist. Avoiding eye contact, I entered my sedan and started the engine. I was late for work, again, and I had eaten the last ripe banana. The radio kicked on in the middle of a song. I vaguely recognized it, something about a fellow named Johnny and a lady, Frankie. Even over the radio and the engine, I could hear Marla shouting, "Idiot!" she called. "Don't walk away from me! You're dead!" To her credit, Marla could really project her voice. As I shifted into drive, the banana peel landed with a goopy thump on my windshield. Marla has an arm like Roberto Clemente. A few passes with the windshield wipers flung the peel onto the street, but a potassium-rich smudge remained. "He was her man," the radio sang, "but he was doing her wrong." I continued on to work. How did things get this bad? How did Marla and I go from salivating and moaning in each other's presence to such a dismal, dysfunctional arrangement? Maybe this is where love always ends up. Maybe love, like smoked fish, is at first pungent and satisfying, but then, if left around too long, well... I drove on, from our rented duplex to my job at the ad agency, an old folk song in my ears, and I started to have an idea. As a professional songwriter, I understood the power of a poignant song. Well, more accurately, I was a jingle writer, and even more specifically, a writer of discount pet food jingles. Even at the top of my field, my greatest hope was to get my well-crafted 15 seconds onto some low-rated children's show. But that would change. My life was a disaster, and the only way of going out with any dignity at all would be to live on in song as a murder ballad. No, I wasn't going to drown Marla down by the river. She'd never go for that. It would be me who must be bumped off. Me who would live on as the heroically deceased. Murder. It was my only hope for a good life. My plan was threefold. First, I had to be awful. I didn't have the spine for infidelity, but I had a lot of other ideas. I would lose my job and spend all day in sweatpants, laughing a little too loud at online comics. I would undercook her fried eggs and put dish soap in the washing machine. I would water our houseplants with vinegar. Second, I would pen the song itself, to be found after my departure, a final congé. Third, I would bombard Marla with cheerfully violent folk music and leave potential weaponry around the house within easy reach. Baseball bats, cast iron skillets, lengths of rope, bear traps. By the time I had arrived at work, I already had a first verse. Oh, Ronald was the dullest man that ever walked the earth. With a head as hollow as a jack-o'-lantern, no wiser since his birth. And Marla, fair and wondrous lass, she had her pick of men. She shunned her suitors one by one and chose Ronnie Littleton. She snuffed her lover out with a blunt object. It was a Cincinnati winter. The banana was the clincher. For the first time in my life, I had a real achievable goal.
Thank you.
As soon as I walked into work, I started trying to get myself fired. My supervisor intercepted me before I could clock in. "You're late, Ron," she scolded. "I've got a streak going," I said. "Can't stop now." I made my way to my desk and lied down on the floor, waiting for someone to notice. After an hour, I was bored and drowsy and knew I would need a new strategy. With a thick red marker, I began drawing cartoon dogs and cats all over my desk. Then I started on my cubicle wall, then other walls, then windows. I stood on a stool and tagged the ceiling. "Nice," a coworker said. "Edgy." I marked up every surface I could find on my way to the supervisor's office, including my own forehead. I entered without knocking and told her I was grumpy and needed the day off. She shrugged and went back to work. On my way home, I stopped at a record shop, an antique mall, and a sporting goods emporium. With the car full of blunt objects and compact discs, I headed back to Marla, singing to myself through lunchtime traffic.
Ronnie, oh little Ronnie Littleton, such a lousy gentleman, such a sorry disappointment. Ronnie, oh little Ronnie Littleton, cut down in his prime, bludgeoned with cast iron by his one and only Valentine, by Marla, his irritable wife.
With a tumbling sort of panic, I noticed there was a strange automobile in our driveway. It was a glistening SUV, well cared for, frequently washed, with vanity plates that read, "Big Ike." I parked on the street and noticed that our bedroom curtains were pulled shut. I crept to the window and placed an ear to the glass and heard just the kinds of sounds you might expect to hear from behind shut bedroom curtains. The kinds of sounds Frankie heard as she peered over the transom at Johnny and Nellie Bly. The sounds of Marla doing me wrong. Now I was angry. Yes, partly because I was being increasingly cuckolded even as I stood there. But mainly because this was screwing up my plan. I would probably have to rewrite the whole song. Not knowing what else to do, I picked out the biggest cast iron skillet from the trunk, unlocked the front door of my home, and loudly made my entrance known.
"Ike!"
I bellowed. After several minutes, they emerged from the room, Ike fully dressed, my wife in the same red bathrobe as earlier. We quietly looked each other over. Marla's eyes shifted between my face and the skillet. I looked only at Ike, who was wearing a Gold's Gym tank top and camo pants. He had a goatee, but no other hair above his eyebrows. He was big.
"Get lost," I hissed.
He ambled towards me.
"Next time you should knock," he said, giving me a little shove with his elbow.
With my neck muscles bulging and my face full of embarrassment, I swung my skillet at the man. The handle slipped, and the pan loudly scuttered along the floor, cracking tile as it went. When the pan finally settled, Ike put a beefy hand on my shoulder.
"This guy,"
he said to Marla, shaking his head. I squirmed out of his grip and he walked out the door, mumbling just loud enough for us to hear.
"Same time next week, huh, Marla?"
I turned to my wife, who gave me a very quick pout. She headed to the doorway and shouted,
"Idiot! Don't you ever come back here! You're dead!"
When Ike was out of our cul-de-sac, Marla collapsed into my unprepared arms, sobbing. "Oh, Ronnie," she blubbered. "What would I do without you? How did this happen?" We used to be so happy. I said nothing, only held her for a time, then walked out and started unloading the car. What's all this? She asked. Oh, some decorations, I said, arranging the cast irons and oversized mallets in corners, on shelves. How nice, she said. For days, neither of us spoke of Ike, or the bear trap being used as a doorstep in our living room, or the endless murder ballads coming from the stereo. Until one morning, Marla turned to me and said, Ronnie, I've been so awful. I'm sorry. Can we start from scratch? Can we have a redo? I'm sorry too, Marla, I said. And we went back to buttering our toast. I decided I would have to live on in the ordinary way. By breathing often, by screwing up, by doing the best I could in every excruciating moment. My dog food jingles would have to fulfill me, and I would forgive Marla. It was much harder this way. So much more is expected of the living than the tragically dead. That evening, Marla and I sat snuggling on the sofa, watching the news. A report came on about a local man, a personal trainer named Ike, who was found bludgeoned and deceased in the woods outside of town. There were no suspects, no apparent motive. Marla and I glanced at each other, wondering just what the other knew. Big Ike, Big Ike, been sleeping with my wife. Now he won't be doing more than snoring for eternity. A permanent hunger strike. Big Ike, Big Ike, lays beneath the headstone, slowly decomposing with moles and worms and crickets, and no one knows who did it.
What we would do.
She shot her man, there's no dispute. She shot her man with a Rudy Toot Toot.
You're listening to KBOO, and this is an episode of Steam Folk, presented by the Steam Radio Syndicate. We're broadcasting live from the deck of the UV-746 tugboat out on the Willamette River, with an hour of songs and stories inspired by Frankie and Johnny, the classic American murder ballad. You just heard from Leo J. reading his story, The Ballad of Big Ike, from The Winch Room. Now back to The Winch Room with our featured band, Three for Silver.
The sailor won't keep his hands in his pockets. He won't write his letters in red. Bad luck is like bad news, with no end to how it spreads. The sailor killed a writ on New Year's Day, and he nailed his right boot to the mast. Well, he never whistles on board, they say, but wakes each morning with his flask. Beneath the roots of the ocean, under the shade of the sea, gather these laughing bones, and darling, beg mercy for me. Above the branches of clouds, atop the crown of the sky, your tears fall and join the waves where I lie. Good luck is offered to the sailor.
Well, we're not done with Frankie's story just yet. In fact, it actually ends pretty close to home. Here's Jim Petzold in the meat locker.
And that's how the leopard got its spots. Okay, one more story, then it's off to bed. Let's see. All right, here's a little story about your great aunt Frankie. You won't remember her, but the rest of the world does. Seems that, a long time ago down in St. Louis, Frankie had a sweetheart named Johnny. Now, Johnny didn't always treat her right, and one night, when Johnny came to her bedside, after a long night of cavorting on the town, she shot him down. She claimed it was self-defense, and the judge, he agreed. And she got off. Even got her gun back. But for the rest of her days, she was haunted by that fateful night. Apparently, someone wrote a song about it. They even made a Hollywood picture show. Well, Frankie needed a change of scenery and moved out to Portland, Oregon. Opened a little shoeshine place over on Fremont. Hung out a shingle, went to work, and scraped out a meager living shining shoes for rich folk. One day, this long, tall fellow from Albuquerque came to town, planning to head out to Pendleton for the roundup. Dropped off a beautiful pair of alligator and bullhide Durangos for a little polishing. Frankie reached into one of the boots in order to get a good hold on it to buff it out, and wouldn't you know it, there was a spider or a scorpion or some venomous little critter in there. Stung her something crazy. Never did find the little devil. So she wrapped her hand and went on with the polishing, thinking nothing of it. That night, however, after the poison worked its way into her body, she started to feel a bit odd, came down with a fever and chills, and got all kinds of delirious. And she dreamt about all manner of sinister, creepy, crawly varmints. She dreamt she was a black widow spider in her magnificent web, 8 slender jackknife legs with stiletto heels, red hourglass belly, and 2 empty, coal black eyes looking out on her plunder. Hundreds of bugs of all sorts, love bugs, stink bugs, cicadas, and you name it, half wrapped in their silken tombs, writhing and wriggling to free themselves, drained of their vital bodily fluids. But the strangest thing, and I say strange, that was mostly just weird, every bug in its death throes had the face of her beloved Johnny, and they were all screaming, "Why, Frankie, why? What did I ever do to you?" Well, these night visions lasted for a long time, drove Frankie quite insane, and eventually the authorities were left with no other choice but to have her committed to the loony bin, where she spent the last years of her life, haunted by 1,000 Johnny-faced bugs. Every night, though the home she lived in was clinically disinfected, polished hardwoods and hospital corner beds, Johnny bugs would shed their cocoon, crawl from her state-issued slippers, creep up her bedposts, under her sheets, and inch all over her body. And as if that weren't enough, they'd find their way into her ears and work their way deep into her brain. And there they would stay, always asking the question, "Why?" And the last thing she saw was Johnny's shocked and bewildered face. And the last thing she said, according to the nurses, "You done me wrong, Johnny. You done me wrong." The end. Alrighty then. Night night. Won't let the bed bugs bite.
There goes that rubber tired hack. 12 men gone to the graveyard. And 11 coming back. Johnny was my man, but he done me.
That was Jim Petzold, tucking us in with his original bedtime story, which contained more truth than you might think. Frankie actually did live her latter years right here in Portland. After a few arrests for running the same old tricks, she went honest and opened a shoeshine parlor. But the song continued to torment her. Neighborhood kids would sing it while she played Hands of Solitaire on her porch. And two big-budget Hollywood movies depicted her with all the manner of deplorable traits. Frustrated by reporters and gawkers and without a cent to show for her infamy, Frankie sued Republic Pictures for damages. Unfortunately, nothing came of it but more bad press. Late in life, a senile and gray-haired Frankie Baker settled into the Multnomah County Poor Farm. It's now the site of McMenamin's Edgefield. There, she began frightening and attacking the women around her. Well, this old lady suffered from persecution complex, and for the first time since she shot her man in St. Louis, she was dangerous. They sent her off to the state asylum in Pendleton, where she spent her final days. To the end of our time together. Thank you. For Steam Radio Syndicate, I'm Kitty Rocket, and this has been Frankie and Johnny, an episode of Steam Folk. We thank you for joining us aboard the UV-746 steamship. Until next time, remember this. Whenever you feel like committing a heinous crime, just sing about it instead. So long. Thank you.
KBOO, Portland. There we go, and here we are again at Far Away Places. From the corner of Cali, California.